That lines Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid tensions, intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is set to testify to public inquiry over the use of emergency powers to end the protests in the capital, Ottawa, in February. And Iran beat Wales 2-0 to keep their World Cup campaign alive, prompting celebrations across the country. Our top story for this half hour, Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says that Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve his goal, which has repeatedly been decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said that Turkey carried out new raids on the northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strikes since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. They've denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemned an anti-Iran resolution adopted by the UN Human Rights Council, dismissing it as totally unacceptable. The ministry said the resolution that called for an international probe into Iran's handling of recent riots was a move by a small group of Western countries that condemned those countries for pushing the Human Rights Council to adopt their will in the form of an anti-Iran resolution. The ministry also expressed regret that the Geneva-based council has once again been exploited to serve the interests of a small group of countries. It said the resolution was a strategic mistake made by Germany and some other Western states on the basis of miscalculations and pressures from special political lobbies and anti-Iran media. The ministry added that such political short-sightedness will ultimately harm the interests of those countries. Earlier we spoke to journalist and political commentator Mohsen Abbas. He told us about the hypocrisy of Western countries, particularly Germany, which called for the Iran probe.
Look, the Germans and the West and the Europeans should really just be quiet about human rights, because they are the ones who've inflicted the most casualties, the most dead, the most injured, the most tortured on any level or any spectrum of human rights. What they've done in Syria, what they've done in Libya, what they've done in Iraq, what they've done in Afghanistan. I mean, they ought to really just, quite frankly, they should just shut up. Because if Iran wants to talk about their internal situations, then it could also start talking about the sex slave trade, the pornography industry, and the violation of women's rights in terms of neoliberal cultures, which the Germans and the other Europeans are promoting. Now they want to take those to Eastern countries as well through the Agenda 2030. And we've just seen the German football team put their mouths over their hands over their mouths as an objection to the fact that they wanted to promote LGBT rights in Qatar. In somebody else's country, they wanted to go and dictate what their values are, or what they should do in terms of their legal actions against people who are regarded maybe as indecent. Basically, this is an arrogance. It's a Western, NATO, European, okay, American arrogance against the rest of the world to say that they dictate what human rights should and shouldn't be. They don't.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is set to testify to public inquiry later in the day. He'll defend his government's use of wartime measures to clear out trucker protests earlier this year. Trudeau has been facing strong criticism over the use of emergency powers to end the protests in the capital, Ottawa, in February. Over the weeks, truckers from across Canada were present in the city, rejecting mandatory COVID vaccines. Solidarity rallies took place, too, with the protesters' demands expanding to an anti-establishment agenda. The truckers-led protests brought Ottawa to a standstill and disrupted trade. Trudeau's Friday testimony will close out Canada's Public Order Emergency Commission hearings ongoing over the past weeks. Trudeau has previously said he invoked the rarely used emergency powers to end what he called dangerous and unlawful activities. Opponents reject that. A ruling by the British Supreme Court has dealt a blow to Scottish nationalist bid to take another step toward independence. Britain's highest court has rejected a bid by the Scottish government to hold a new referendum on independence without London's consent. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that she is disappointed by the ruling.
It's been described as a blow to Scotland's bid for independence from the United Kingdom. The attempt has hit a roadblock following a ruling by Britain's top court. The Supreme Court has said the Scottish government does not reserve the right to hold a second referendum on whether to break from the UK without permission from London. It says the laws that created the Scottish Parliament in 1999 do not have the power to legislate on areas of the Constitution. That includes the union between Scotland and England.
For all these reasons, which are set out more fully in the judgment, the court unanimously concludes that the proposed bill does relate to reserved matters. Accordingly, in the absence of any modification of the definition of reserved matters by an order in council under section 30 of the Scotland Act or otherwise, the Scottish Parliament does not have the power to legislate for a referendum on Scottish independence.
The Scottish National Party was trying to force a vote next October as it did not have the approval of Britain's Parliament. The British Prime Minister has welcomed the court's decision, describing it as clear and definitive to move on from the independence debate.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me start by saying we respect the clear and definitive ruling of the, on the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. And what I would say to the honourable gentleman, that firstly, I am looking forward to also seeing the moderator of Scotland tomorrow. And I think that the people of Scotland want us to be working on fixing the major challenges that we collectively face, whether that's the economy, supporting the NHS, or indeed supporting Ukraine.
But Scotland's First Minister has strongly criticised the move, saying that democracy is threatened. Nicola Sturgeon accused the British government, quote, outright democracy denial.
My expectation, in the short term at least, is that the UK government will maintain its position of outright democracy denial. That position is, in my view, not just unsustainable, it is also utterly self-defeating.
The decision by Britain's top court has triggered an angry response from the Scottish people. They have held a protest to slam the decision and to demand a second referendum to secede from Britain.
And the first referendum on Scottish independence from the UK was held in 2014. More than 44% of voters said yes to secession. Many have been asking for a second referendum ever since London opted for an exit from the European Union in 2016. Back then, Scottish voters voted heavily against Brexit.
Opinion polls suggest that Scots remain narrowly divided on whether to break from the UK and that a clear consensus in either direction has yet to emerge. England and Scotland have been joined in a political union since 1707, but ever since then, there have been demands by the Scottish people to secede from that union, which was imposed through a bloody war.
Scottish voters in our election last May elected a majority of MSPs who support having another referendum and indeed support independence. So the question goes back to the pro-union side is what are the rights of Scottish voters? What right to democracy or self-determination do they have?
Since 1999, Scotland has had a devolved government. That means a number of decisions are made by the Parliament in Edinburgh. However, many Scots believe that is not enough, and they want more power and say in the ways that Scotland is run. In September 2014, when Scottish voters were given the choice of staying in the UK or becoming an independent country, they backed staying in the UK by 55 to 45%. Independent supporters say Scotland needs to take its future into its own hands. They also argue that Scotland should no longer tie its future to the UK and its Conservative government. Scottish voters also voted heavily against Britain's exit from the European Union.
We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will. In my view, that can only be an election. The next national election scheduled for Scotland is, of course, the UK general election, making that both the first and the most obvious opportunity to seek what I described back in June as a de facto referendum.
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has said her Scottish National Party would immediately seek to rejoin the bloc with Scotland as an independent country. Last month, the party published an economic prospectus arguing Scotland's economy would be stronger and fairer after independence.
Nurses in Britain are planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase have been turned down by the government. The strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union would be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales and Northern Ireland will be walking out on December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that would help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to the demands of healthcare workers.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the health secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged the difficult situation that healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of the unprecedented inflation. He stressed that his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. The planned strikes by the nurses would be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors that are struggling to get by as the UK grapples with a 40-year high inflation rate of 11.1%. Energy ministers warn of economic disaster for the EU in 2023 unless a plan to secure affordable gas supplies can be agreed between member states. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between €150 and €200 is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand, in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
Leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for now, but do stay tuned up next. It's Reza with all the latest sports updates.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Sports News. Iran's national football team have thrashed Wales with two late goals almost at the end of the game. Iran struck twice in the dying moments of added time to earn a 2-0 win over 10-man Wales in their Group B clash at the World Cup today. Ruzbeh Cheshmi and Ramireza Yan scored to give Iran a famous win, which moved them into second place in a group behind England, who faced the United States of America later today. Team Iran have made several attempts to open the scoring, but it was a bad luck for the Iranian team at first, as the first attempts ended up with a goal was judged as offside by the referee and rejected. In the second half, we got another attempt by Sardar Azmoun, hitting two times at the woodwork. Iranian people have taken to the streets all across the country to celebrate the country's national football team against Wales in the Qatar World Cup 2022. People hoisted Iran's flags and chanted slogans in support to Team Melli, who have defeated Wales in a breathtaking match 2-0. The citizens honked their horns and waved pictures of the Iranian players while dancing and shouting on the streets. President Raisi sent a congratulation message to the national football team and the Iranian people for the victory. He addressed Team Melli and said, "Hardworking and zealous players of Iran's national football team did a great, sweet job and made Iranian nation happy and proud." Raisi said that all members of the team have our blessing in the tournament up until the last moments of the games. That's all. Thank you so much for being with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. بسیج in view of آیت الله خامنه ای. In the name of God, سلام and welcome to the program. We are in the Basij week. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued the formation of Basij Volunteer Forces on November 26, 1979. This order clearly showed the Imam's foresightedness, as no war had been waged yet. At that time, saboteurs and insurgents would instigate chaos and terrorist acts in the country with the support of foreign powers, especially the U.S. Imam Khomeini, who always relied on people's power, called on them to come to the scene again to thwart the threats. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said about Basij, "The anniversary of Basij formation is reminiscent of the glorious memory of combatants who, during the eight-year imposed war, drew the most beautiful paintings of self-sacrifice with nobility and humbleness, coupled with bravery and valor. It is the memory of chaste and valorous men who were the lions of day and ascetics of night, who mixed the battlefield against the Satan with the struggle against the soul prompting to evil, and turned the war front into the mihrab of worship. They are the young men who left their youthful pleasures and desires for God's sake, and the elderly who preferred the battlefield to comfort, and the men who sacrificed the love of wife, children, friends, and land in the altar of the divine love. It is the memory of the great men who, with little show-off, embarked on defending the divine values and were not scared of the bogus awe of the powers which had come to fight the divine values for preserving the culture and values of the ignorant West." The foresightedness of Imam Khomeini in formation of Basij Volunteer Organization yielded fruit as less than 10 months later, the Iraqi Ba'athist regime staged an all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran at the behest of its masters in Washington. Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq, attacked and occupied parts of the Iranian soil to destroy the Islamic Revolution. But the stiff and unprecedented resistance of the Iranian forces, especially the Basiji volunteers, prevented his dream to materialize. Hence, the war took 8 years. Today also, the Basij forces are firmly defending the lofty goals of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "As long as Basij exists, the Islamic system and the Islamic Republic will not be threatened by the enemies. This is a fundamental principle." The leader believes that the Basij was a sapling planted by Imam Khomeini for the sake of God to serve the people and the Islamic Revolution. And now it has turned into a sturdy and thick tree which keeps bearing fruits in Iran and abroad. This position has been attained due to the divine characteristics such as spirituality, sincerity, popularity, insight, religious awareness, obedience of leader, simple way of living, self-sacrifice, and preparedness. Today, millions of Iranians are the members of Basij to defend Iran and the Islamic Revolution devotedly. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Basij is an establishment in which the purest men and the most selfless and prepared youth of the country have gathered for the lofty goals of this nation. No doubt, the role of the youth is undeniable in Basij, and basically the main structure of this popular organization has been built by faithful and vivid youths. Fortunately, various strata of people have answered to the call of Basij. In every part of Iran, various strata from citizens, villagers, nomads, university students, employees, school students, workers, farmers, and other parts of the country have answered positively the invitation of Basij establishment." Insight is very important for Basij forces. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "Dear youths, dear Basijis, increase the insight day by day. Do not let some material needs and trivial matters block your insight. Keep your insight and recognize your enemy. The enemy has different tricks, and that nation will be successful who is not deceived." Another feature of Basij is sincerity and anonymity. The Basij forces fulfill their duties only for the sake of God, without any expectation. That's why the leader says that a group of the best and most devoted people enter every field that the country and the system needs with their full ability, while they do not want reward and salary and do not seek name and fame. This is very important. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader says, Basij is not dependent on money, title, ostentation, or order from above. Ayatollah Khamenei stresses the need for Basij, saying, it is not that we have the army and the IRGC and another armed force called Basij. No, Basij is the body of a nation that has been trained to take arm and, in case of the country's need, shoulders the biggest and heaviest load, as it was seen during the war. According to the military experts, Basij is the most comprehensive, coherent, efficient, and selfless force in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei believes that Basij should always be equipped with the most updated and useful knowledge and technology in every field. He says, Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the scientific arenas, technological arenas, scientific innovations, and unknown horizons of knowledge. Imam Khomeini said, I always envy the purity and sincerity of Basijis and ask God to resurrect me in the hereafter with Basijis as in this world. I am boastful of being a Basiji myself.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. So a look inwards. We have to ask ourselves now, am I traveling towards God? Have I left the home of the self? Have I left the home of the ego? Have I broke the chains of the anaparasti inside of me? It's amazing. Surah Zumar, verse number 29, talks about the idea of multiple gods. I talked about that before. And the beautiful part is that God simply presents two options. Multiple masters, one master. If I said, sorry, God, I have a question for you. There's a third option. What's that third option? No master. None, one, multiple. That should be the example. Right? Maybe you forgot one God. Maybe the ayat na'ubillah is incomplete. He says, no, it's not incomplete. The fact that he doesn't include a third option of no master means that it's not even possible. The thing that masters you is your God. Khalas, period. Understand my youth. The thing that masters you is your God. And because you have free will, I have free will, I can choose my master. It's up to you. So some will say, no, absolutely not. Nobody controls me. Say, that's it. I do what I want. I eat what I want. I go where I want. I am the master of my own domain. And we think that that's an announcement that I am masterless, when the reality is that you have mastered yourself. The mother of all idols, Rumi says, is the self. The mother of all idols is the self. So either you're mastered by yourself, like the Fir'auns, or others, or multiple, or Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Anyways, the idea is that you are going through a journey, and that journey has to reflect the fact that you're leaving home. Now, when you turn inwards, you discover these innate realities, like the need to be distinct. Why not be distinct on the path that will benefit you? So we have the freedom to choose, correct? Allah gave us free will. The beauty of Allah is such that He's so confident that He goes, you know what, if you want to reject me, go ahead. You want to walk away from me? Go ahead. You have that free will. Tell me which other authority figure allows you that type of freedom. Ask the people of Egypt, if one Egyptian walked away from Fir'aun, turned his back on Fir'aun, what would happen to him? Ask the Iraqis of the 80s, they turned their back on Saddam, what would happen? It's not normal for an authority figure to say, look, I give you free will to walk away from me. But God says, go ahead. Go ahead. Walk away from me. Reject me. Eventually now, as Imam Sadiq says to one of his atheist students, that there comes a moment in the middle of the ocean on the boat when all is lost, a major storm hitting, and you have all lost all hope in anyone coming. There's this one glimmer of hope that somebody might save me. That glimmer of hope is God. So God says, go ahead, you can reject me, turn your back towards me, walk away from me, no problem. There'll be a moment where that fitri diamond of worship will be once again revealed, and you'll turn your way back to me. And when you call upon me after years and years, ujibu da'wati da'i idha da'an. I'll answer your call whenever you call me. That's God. That's His beauty. So now, what's that statement? The statement is a very beautiful one. Not mine, never is mine. The idea that in a master-slave relationship, the common equation is, the slave works, the master benefits. The slave works, the master benefits. If the slave calls in sick, the master now is at loss. If the slave gets lazy, the master is at loss. If the slave doesn't work, the master is at loss. But when we enslave ourselves to God, the equation is not that anymore. The equation is actually something else. The equation is the more the slave works, the higher the slave goes. It's not like the master is depending on the slave. The master's level is not contingent on the slave's work. Some people like me think, you know, Imam Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. He says the highest level of ujb, the highest level of narcissism, ujb, self-conceit, this ego, highest level, is that there are those who actually believe that their worship is doing a favor to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now subconsciously, we think, okay, God, here's your namaz, here's your fast, here's your hajj, here's your khums. And that doesn't come about sometimes until a tragedy hits. And then when a tragedy hits, sometimes these words of kufr and shirk come out of our mouth, albeit emotional. We end up saying statements like, God, I did this for you. I did that for you. I worshipped you. I prayed to you. I was this volunteer and that volunteer, and you pay me back by taking my husband away, my wife away, my mother away. So if there is a diamond inside of you, a need inside of you, an innate disposition inside of you that's screaming that I want to be distinct, I want to be distinct, I want to be distinct, why not be distinct on that path that the more you show your distinctness, the higher you go? Now, is there a connection between my external world and my internal distinctness? Yes, there is. Let's examine that quickly. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, even Western philosophy has this great discussion on distinctness. And I asked my youth out there, if you want to kind of, you know, look up this topic, then search it up. There is some great discussions on the need to be distinct. Why does every human being need to be distinct? So again, I'll say it again. It's not that we don't want to be distinct. We want to direct it towards God. Because that's going to be for my benefit. Now, Western philosophy, Western psychology says that this distinctness now is sometimes triggered. It has stimuli. And the stimuli is that it triggers our perception, how we perceive ourselves. Right? How we perceive ourselves is ultimately how we are distinct. So perception and distinction go hand in hand. What is that connector between how I perceive myself and whether or not I'm distinct? Sometimes they say it's your physical appearance. I tell you guys, there is such wisdom behind a lot of the Ahkam rulings inside the deen. A lot of the Ahkam rulings. I talked about certainty and doubt. All of these talks now are coming together. Nights ago, I talked about the fact that sometimes we don't understand a certain law of God, a law in Islam, and especially my young guys, I love you, but there's an ego about you guys sometimes, that look, convince me, then I'll follow that law. I talked about the fact that sometimes my elders now, they got to a certain level of yaqeen through the path of amal. I don't know why I'm doing it, but I'm going to keep doing it. There are many of my youth want to reach yaqeen through the path of ilm and knowledge. So Asad Bhai, please convince me why this, why that, why this, why did God make this halal and this haram and that makruh? Why 124,000 prophets? Why not 15 imams? Because if there were 15 imams, you would ask, why are there 15 imams? And the answer is that sometimes submission dictates to us that I may not know why I'm doing it. It's enough that he tells me.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The question that has haunted the Brits' minds these days is that whether Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, could handle the looming recession in Britain. This question is answered by experts in different media websites. Stay tuned for the details, please. Global Times wrote, after a month of political struggle and economic hardship, Britons are now looking at Rishi Sunak. their third prime minister in 2 months, and the first British Asian prime minister, also one of the richest country ever had. Yet Chinese observers are cautious that he could be the savior of a crisis-laden UK. The recent frequent change of prime ministers in the UK has thrown the country into a once-in-a-generation political turmoil. Although the selection of Sunak offers a momentary relief, experts are warning that Sunak faces several uphill challenges, including saving the crumbling economy and navigating through political headwinds, which if he fails to do, might toss the country into yet another impasse. Sunak has used his first speech as prime minister to warn the UK is in the grips of an economic crisis, as he vowed to fix mistakes made by Liz Truss and win back voters' trust. Addressing the nation recently, Sunak warned there would be difficult decisions to come in an attempt to regain economic stability and avoid mass borrowing mounting up. He was asked by the King at Buckingham Palace to form a government before officially taking power. Sunak, a former chancellor, won the public support of almost 200 of his Conservative MP colleagues to succeed Liz Truss, who resigned last Thursday after a chaotic 6 weeks in office. Speaking on Sunak's assuming office, Wang Wenbin, spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said recently at a press briefing that he hopes the UK can push the bilateral ties on the right track on the basis of mutual respect and win-win cooperation. Sunak had challenged Truss this summer in race of prime minister, but lost to her in a vote of the party's rank-and-file members. Chinese experts said this latest series of political drama surrounding the UK premiership has exposed the rigidity and decay of UK's political system, which can hardly produce capable politicians to make optimal decisions for the country. The Conservative Party, which is now in power, chooses someone who is eligible for the Downing Street, and before this person presents a decent plan of governance, he or she is stabbed in the back by opponents in the party and steps down. Zhao Junji, a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Institute of European Studies, told the Global Times, describing this pattern has made the UK politics more dramatic than late-night TV drama. He warned that one of the toughest tasks Sunak faces is how to survive until next election, originally scheduled for January 2025. Right after Sunak won the Conservative Party leadership race, there were calls for a general election by voices from other political parties. Labour lawmaker Angela Rayner complained that Sunak's accession was a coronation and that the Tories could not keep doling out prime ministers every month. After Truss stepped down, one petition calling for a general election had attracted more than 879,000 signatures. In the UK, general elections must be held at least every 5 years. However, the prospect of Britain seeing its third prime minister since the last poll in 2019 and the second to come into power without a public vote will put pressure on Truss's successor to ask the public for a new mandate, CNN reported. The possibility of earlier elections is very high if Sunak fails to tackle the sky-high inflation in the UK in half a year of his governance, or meets strong pushback of his policies, or encounter major obstacles of forming a cabinet. Li Guangji, a research fellow from the Shanghai Academy of Global Governance and Area Studies under the Shanghai International Studies, told the Global Times. Although observers granted Sunak, who possesses technocratic style of governing, they don't believe he is the savior of a crisis-wrecked UK. Except for different dissent, Sunak is no different from his Conservative Party predecessors. The election is in essence an election within the Conservative Party. Thus, the desirable candidates are just chosen by Conservative Party members who are mostly rich, said Zhao. Zhao noted that Sunak's Indian heritage and his wealth may put him under more strict scrutiny as prime minister, and in return will weigh on his decision-making process. Being a leader from a minority group, he may tend to be more conservative just to avoid wide criticism, and he will be very vulnerable if people see his policy as favoring the rich and big companies, said Zhao. The New York Times also reported that critics speculated that Sunak's Indian heritage might have hurt him in the race with some party members this summer. His wealth was viewed as the bigger issue. Also, Middle East Eye wrote, this takes writers to the big question mark surrounding the Sunak premiership. How will he handle the looming recession in Britain? Ever since John Maynard Keynes reinvented the laws of economics in 1930s, governments have increased spending to combat recessions. With a financial black hole to be filled, Sunak's masters in the financial markets will not allow him to boost output through fiscal methods. They will insist on cuts, forcing Britain into austerity. Unemployment will rise. Living standards will fall faster than at any time in the post-war period. Public services will be slashed, meaning poverty and even destitution. Britain has not faced a period like this since the oil crisis in 1970s, and possibly experts fear even the Great Depression of 1930s. So-called Truss economics was an attempt to evade this predicament. Sunak will have to face it. As Chancellor, Sunak has proved that he has the financial skills to manage the national budget. Has this unelected prime minister got the political skills to explain spending cuts and job losses to the British people? On the evidence so far, the answer is no. Sunak started out as favorite to win last summer's Tory leadership campaign. He threw it away because he lacked charm, empathy, and authority. It was quite something to lose to a candidate as useless as Truss, but Sunak managed it. To his great credit, he did warn of the disastrous consequences of Truss's economic plans and had the good sense to steer clear of her short-lived government. But in other respects, he kowtowed to Tory members in his desperation to get the top job. Like her, he launched attacks on activist lawyers and stuck with the shaming and hopeless policy of shipping refugees to Rwanda. When Truss disastrously proposed in a letter to conservative friends of the Zionist regime to ponder a shift of the British embassy in the occupied territories to Al-Quds, hapless Sunak lacked the wit to steer clear of a daft policy certain to damage British interest. Not to be outdone, Sunak actually moved in lockstep with Truss, saying that he too would consider ripping up British foreign policy in the West Asia region in order to follow former US President Donald Trump's decision to shift the embassy. There is already evidence that, like Truss and Johnson before him, Sunak will end up being captured by the Tory right. According to a disturbing report in the Times, Sunak has assured Eurosceptics in private that he will maintain the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, stick with the Rwanda policy, introduce new legislation to prevent the European Convention on Human Rights blocking deportations, and to take a firm line on other ideologies in schools. If this report is accurate, Sunak will seek to win the necessary political capital to pursue brutal austerity policies by pandering to the far right and waging culture wars against the most vulnerable people in the world. To put it another way, he will try and make up for his lack of democratic legitimacy by resorting to ugly populism. If so, he will deserve to fail. Let's hope Britain's first Prime Minister of Asian heritage is better than that and possesses the courage to lead Britain out of the cesspit he inherits from Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. If so, there is a chance, with a lot of luck, that Sunak could become a good Prime Minister at this turmoil in Britain.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The United States' domestic problems are unprecedented in the economic, social, and moral fields, as well as their internal conflicts and the blood-stained divisions inside the country. Another sign is also their miscalculation of the world's affairs. For example, 20 years ago, they attacked Afghanistan. The Taliban were in power at that time. In order to eradicate the Taliban, they invaded Afghanistan, spent money, committed crimes, had casualties, killed a lot of people, and so on.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They stayed in Afghanistan for 20 years, and after 20 years, they were forced to exit Afghanistan, handing the country over to the Taliban. What does that imply? It shows their miscalculations. It shows that the calculation system in the United States is no longer an organized, orderly, and accurate system. They don't comprehend the issue well. They misunderstand them and act in a wrong manner as a result of this. Their attack on Iraq also ended in failure. The fact that you see elections in Iraq today where an Iraqi citizen is elected, this is not what the Americans wanted. When Saddam went, the Americans instated a military official as the Iraqi's head of state. And then they realized that they cannot continue with a military official. So they removed him and replaced him with a civilian. Mr. Bremer, as the top official in Iraq instead. This means that the country of Iraq was to be governed by a non-Arab, non-Iraqi American ruler. Now, I mentioned that I have some matters to say about Haj Qasem Soleimani. One of the things is this issue, but now is not the right time to talk about it. This was their intention. Their intention was not to leave Iraq.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.